Nice to see people today, see faces for the first time in a long time. So the talk today is going to be weaving together a little bit of Dogen, a little bit of Lotus Sutra, a little bit of term closing, and how we hold different paths of practice here at Dharma Rain. It's a little more on the explanatory side of things than the how-to side of things. The reason the term closing bit is in there is that this is the last day. Tomorrow is really the last day, but tomorrow's day off. So this is the last day of term. We do three-month periods, kind of alternating a fairly intensive schedule and then a lighter schedule. And we mark those, typically, with a ceremony to start and to end it. And that's a way of acknowledging the intention and the effort that goes into it and the transformation that happens. I'm going to read the part of the dedication for the spring term closing ceremony. This is basically the same ceremony that happens every time. Like it's, you know, there's a few words changed depending on the season, depending on opening and closing, but it's the same elements for opening and closing. The spring wind has blown across the fields, and the light of summer controls all directions. The Lord of Enlightenment emerges, and on this day the Dharma has been fulfilled everywhere. Nothing disturbed us for 90 days, and all trainees were at peace. The power and virtue of this teaching protected us, and we were deeply grateful. With respect and devotion, we chant the names of Buddha and bow to the Bodhisattvas who guard this temple. So 90 days of being at peace. It's worth celebrating. It's a lot of willingness, a lot of resolution go into that. So honor that effort that has been put out by your fellow practitioners here. That being seen by each other in practice is part of the one of the threads that runs through this talk. And the impetus for it came from a conversation I had, I don't know, half a year ago maybe, with several priest friends I have. I meet with this group once a month, and I it's something that I consider really important both for me personally and also just for the temple, that teachers have trusted and in-depth and ongoing relationships with, you know, peers that help them feel supported and understood and accountable. So we have this within the Dharma Rain Sangha, that STRAT, the Dharma Rain Active Transmitted Teachers is the acronym, and that group meets every month. But many of us also have groups outside of the Sangha for a different perspective, different language. So anyway, one of them, Colin, who teaches in Nova Scotia, was describing some special event that he attended. And this was a week-long sesshin. I think it was a week-long sesshin. I may just be making up a detail there, but it was a sesshin at any point, right? And he was serving as jisha and translator for Hoitsu Suzuki, which is Shunryu Suzuki's son of Zen Mind, Beginner with Mind fame. And so he spent the whole retreat translating for him in Sanzen. And so people would bring in life questions, meditation stuff, whatever was appearing in the moment. And he described, you know, Hoitsu as just like being like just kind of a caricature of being like benign, benevolent, sweet, warm, friendly, kind of beatific, right? And at the end of sesshin, Cohen hadn't had a chance to come in for Sanzen himself because he was translating the whole time. And so when it was over, he asked, can I ask you a question? And Hoitsu said, oh, of course, sure, please. And he said, well, you know, I'm not sure if it's okay for me to ordain anybody, because I was trained in an environment where I had this monastic kind of container, this support around me, and that's how I know how to do it. And Hoetsu transformed from being this like friendly figure to like full on fire and brimstone, and like, you have a responsibility! And, you know, it really made an impression on Cohen. And that intensity, that passion. And, you know, he hasn't ordained anybody yet. You know, the conditions have not been ripe. And it's a real, like, you know, there's a pang there for him. So it makes an interesting question, right? Like, over time, we accrue a kind of responsibility to the practice, to the Sangha, to the Dharma, to the tradition, as we reap the benefits in our own life. You know, like, there's a natural wishing for others to benefit as well. When we find the treasure, we want to share it. And so Hoetsu was emphatically affirming that aspect of things. But he didn't address the question of, like, how that happens, right? What's the context that supports that, you know, a healthy formation? And especially the healthy formation of a monastic, and does that require a monastic context? So formation is the process of being shaped by our spirituality, right? Becoming fluent in it, having it become more and more a central core in our life. I think for, you know, most people, like, that's a 10 to 15 year process. And as opposed to like the 2 to 3 year process that people envision or sign up for or would like it to be. And it doesn't start at once necessarily. I mean, this is kind of like, as there's real traction, as practice is actually changing how you live your life. And just because it starts doesn't mean it can't stagnate, right? That it can't just kind of pause out. So it's easy to imagine a formation process that doesn't really go well, that doesn't create the kind of transformation that it was intended. And in a way, there's a certain inevitability to the bumps and bruises along the way, and those bumps and bruises are part of what grounds the practice and makes it durable and trustworthy. You know, it adds more perspective, and that's part of, and that perspective that it adds is part of what makes it visible to those who have gone through it. There's a fascicle by Dogen called Hoki Ten Hoki, and it's about the Lotus Sutra. It describes how we relate to the Dharma, and it uses extensive imagery from the Lotus Sutra. And a central motif in there is how, you know, whether we turn the wheel of the Dharma or whether the wheel of the Dharma turns us. And it's the flower of Dharma. And that's referring to Shakyamuni and Makakashyo. So in this fascicle, one of the things that Dogen does is he tells this story of Hotatsu, who's you know, a monk but a scholar who is really proud of his devotion. And he's recited the Lotus Sutra thousands of times, and he knows it forwards and backwards and up, down, side to side. Like, he's got it. And he's bragging about this to Daikon Enno, the sixth ancestor. And he says, well, okay, I have some questions, and why don't you recite it, and I'll see if I can help you with it. So Hotatsu does, and Huineng interrupts at some point. And he says, stop. The fundamental point of this sutra is the purpose of the Buddha's appearance in the world. Although it expounds many metaphors, the sutra does not go beyond this. What is that purpose? Only the one great matter. The one great matter is just the Buddha's wisdom itself. It is to disclose, to display, to realize, and to enter. The one great matter is naturally the wisdom of the Buddhas, and someone who is equipped with the wisdom is already a Buddha. You must now believe that the Buddha's wisdom is simply your own natural state of mind. So he's saying, what is practice for? A formation of Buddhas. Wisdom, wisdoming, wisdom. And there's lots of different ways to do this. You know, in the Lotus Sutra, the imagery that they, you know, is used there is that there's many different vehicles. There's many different, like, animals that might pull your cart. And there are some that are pulled by deer and some, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's a whole range. But all of those animals, all of those carts fit in the cart that is pulled by the white ox. And it's saying that, like, all the different strains of Buddhism, all the different, like, vehicles, it's getting at that same thing. Wisdom, wisdoming, wisdom. How do you create a Buddha? How do you make that Buddha appear? Huineng adds a verse. When the mind is in delusion, the flower of Dharma turns. When the mind is in realization, we turn the flower of Dharma. Unless we are clear about ourselves, however long we recite the sutra, it will become an enemy because of its meanings. Without intention, the mind is right. With intention, the mind becomes wrong. When we transcend both with and without, we ride eternally in the white ox cart. So all those carts fit in that single cart, that single path, that single way. And all the differences in how we practice fit within that prajna, unfurling in a way that generates more prajna. So that accessibility, that universality, that like open-handedness that is being spoken to, described by the Lotus Sutra, is one of the founding principles of Dharma Rain. Right? We try to have a very open door. Dharma Rain is a allusion to the Lotus Sutra. And that the Dharma Rain falls everywhere equally. So practices offered in many different ways, in different forms, at different stages in practice for varying levels of commitment. And although all those differences are acknowledged, I think this is a somewhat unusual context in how little emphasis we place on those differences from a value standpoint, you know, a higher or a lower. In this talk, I'm kind of zooming in on the differences between monastic and lay paths and how they both fit equally in this white ox cart. Dharma Rain is unusual in American Zen in having a full-time residential monastic practice as part of its offerings. And it's unusual in having lay practice be fully recognized and empowered. So these two forms of practice, the lay path and the monastic path, support and are supported by each other. Wisdom, wisdoming, wisdom happens by either route. The differences that have to do with the form one's life takes, the lifestyle we partake of, not the depth of one's realization. There's a line in the lay disciple ceremony, so people who have a roksyu like this have gone through that ceremony, or a black one, and it says, I have changed my form but kept my wish, letting go of worldly attachments. No, I have kept my form but refined my wish, letting go of worldly attachments. I will live my life and search for the truth. I vow to help others. And that's a line that we're all pretty familiar with because every time someone goes through that, and often there's a batch of people doing the ceremony, the whole assembly recites that line together. So it kind of works its way in. The monastic ordination ceremony is basically that same ceremony with a few extras. And one of the few changes is that the corresponding line in the Shukei Tokudu, or monastic ordination ceremony, is recited only by the teacher, the person doing the ordaining. And that says, as you change your form, you keep your wish, cutting off worldly attachments. Leaving the world in search for the truth, you will help countless others. So the question is just about lifestyle, the form our life takes. Does the form stay the same, or does it take a different and particular shape? There's a neutrality to that. Dogen says, it is just moment by moment of red mind upon which we rely solely. So do not worry about the mind being deluded. Your actions are the Bodhisattva way itself. They are to serve the Buddhas, which is original practice of the Bodhisattva way. What you disclose, display, realize, and enter is, in every case, an instance of the flower of Dharma turning. That red mind is intimacy or momentariness or vibrancy, suchness, immediacy. It's not dependent on the form. That's what Dogen's getting at there. We all have access to that immediacy, to that suchness. There's a tendency to think that it relies on form because that gives us an out, right? That makes it a little bit safer. It's not up to us right now. Conditions might change. So regarding the conditions of a monastic lifestyle, there's significant formal practice that involves full-time service to the Dharma, a life of simplicity. In general, ordained don't have dependents, they live at the temple, they're devoting themselves to taking care of the temple and the Sangha, you know, in various ways, but basically all the time. There's room for individual variation over time, usually after formation, and after really developing a deep trust from the Sangha. We're, you know, like right now, Joshin is working as a chaplain, and that's one way that might manifest. She's passed her period of formation. She's been transmitted. There's room to explore there. The appropriate path for an individual would be something that would, it would have to be a situational and personality fit, and that's something that would be worked out with the Sangha, with the abbot, with the person's teacher. And allowing that variation is part of this attending to the balance between transformation and sustainability. You know, that there can be, So monks are deeply tied to the Sangha, right? The mandala of relationships and activities is the core medium through which practice is displayed. It's displayed in lots of ways, but that's really central. And on the internal practice may be primary. Much of a monastic's time is really devoted to taking care of the temple and those participating in it, either directly or indirectly. And likewise, in turn, the temple has a responsibility to the spiritual growth of the monastic. So being ordained affects this web of relationships then in a variety of ways. There's increased expectation and responsibility for demonstrating presence and stability and maturity, insight, skillfulness. As these qualities are demonstrated over time, the Sangha entrusts more authority, as is the case for any senior, right? That's kind of the red mind aspect of it, the internal transformation part. A difference for monastics is that this plays out in a fairly public way. And, you know, their private lives are part of the Sangha in a way that is not the case for most Sangha members. So, you know, one's internal practice, as well as the, you know, the pitfalls and dead ends that come along with trying to do internal practice, are going to be obvious. The transformations are obvious. The mistakes are obvious. And that visibility is one of, you know, both the toughest parts of the monastic container and also one of the strongest supports. So this is like understanding some of this like interplay, these dynamics is important for this Sangha as a whole. This isn't just explaining things for monks. Like we're all part of this, of that web. We're all affected by these issues. One of the reasons I'm bringing this topic up is that we have a trainee, Yutone, who began her postulant period in March. So she's been practicing here for about 4 years and in residence for 3. Also Zonyo, who's been around for 9 or 10 years maybe, having spent numerous angos here in residency, will be entering postulancy sometime in the next month. And there's a couple others knocking on the door with longer time frames. So postulancy is something that it happens after some period of residency. It's sort of a preparation for ordination. It's like a trial period. Taking on a, you know, one has taken on already a level of responsibility wherein one is basically staff. And it's a period which lasts for 1 or 2 years. And during this period, someone wears those little white squares that Yutone has. And there's a bunch of special practices that postulants do. You know, they are up early before Zazen to attend to the grounds. They're, you know, they get sent to a different monastic environment to kind of broaden their sense of training. It's a trial. Living in a particular form as an experiment to give both the aspirant and the broader Sangha time to calibrate what this might mean. It's important we have that period because it's really important that it's a good fit, both for the individual and for the Sangha as a whole. Since, you know, like in the last 25 years, about 1/3 of the people who moved in thinking, I'm going to be ordained, have actually been ordained for a while. So it's, you know, it's I don't know, that seems about right, but that may be a surprise. It's an interesting and important question. Most people who let practice shape their lives, who get serious about this, have to ask that question. Like, would a monastic lifestyle work for me? What is the path to allowing the full turning of the flower of Dharma, right? The flower of Dharma turning means the mind is in delusion, the mind being deluded is just the flower of Dharma turning. This being turned is not to be rejoiced at, and it is not to be hoped for. It is not gained, and it does not come. Even so, when the flower of Dharma is turning, there is neither a second nor a third. So part of Dogen's commentary here is he's popping the balloon a little bit. You know, it's not what we get out of it, right? There's this kind of causal thinking that may like be adding energy to this question for people. And there's a certain skillful means, you know, like in the Lotus Sutra, the burning house parable of like, there's this house that's on fire, the kids are inside because they've got their toys. It's a really dangerous situation. The parent can't convince them to come out by saying, hey, it's dangerous. So the parent offers toys instead. And like, hey, you really like this. Here's a carrot, right? Come on out. And so it's that kind of skillful means that, like, but that's not how the causality of transformation really works. It's much bigger than that. It's much more porous than that. It's galactic. But until we have enough of it, like, in the rearview mirror where we've been through it, we've seen that effect, we've watched how we were involved in that turning of the flower or being turned by the flower of Dharma, it helps to, until we have that in our memory, it helps to be able to look forward, to look for that carrot, to see what we might get out of it. Even if it's not the best representation of reality, it may still be useful. One of the things, going back to that story in the beginning about Koun and Hoitsu, one of the things that kind of made that stick for me is that, you know, like we talk once a month, we spend an hour or two together. And so, and the point of it is to, I mean, you know, we're friends, there's a relationship, but it's also to bring our teaching koans, you know, like what are we struggling with? What are we unsure of? What do we need an outside perspective on? Things like that. And, you know, like, I feel very blessed to be in this environment and to have a lot of trainees doing serious work, exploring that vibrancy. And also to have trainees who are taking this particular form of monastic practice and exploring that. And everybody in my group has monastic chops. They've all been trained in formal, long-term, residential practice containers. All of them have spent time in Japan in a monastic setting. And none of that, and I'm the only one who like has a chance to work with people in this way. And there's a like that yearning, that pang that is felt there. And we have the structure, the momentum, the conditions are right to allow that. And it's something that's really special. It's really precious to be able to participate in the turning of this particular flower. So I want, I guess part of my hope with this talk is that we appreciate some of that context as a Sangha. That it's like just how kind of rare that possibility is. And I want to close with the ending invocation for the closing ceremony. The Dharma has been fulfilled, and I deeply appreciate the efforts of all trainees. I thank everyone from the bottom of my heart. All of us are travelers on the same pilgrimage. Today, our training period is over. When the ceremony is finished, please feel free to go wherever you wish. Questions or comments?
Thank you, Kakumiya. And for those on Zoom, it's our usual process. So if you have a comment or question, please type comment or question in the chat box. And if you would like me to read a question on your behalf, please type that into the chat box. And we will alternate between the Zendo and Zoom for questions.
or not.
I have a question on Zoom, Kakamiya, from Tony. Tony, let me find you. Hang on just a second here. And if you can unmute.
Yeah. There was something you were talking about, the different vehicles. There was something I didn't quite pick up. You mentioned that something can become an enemy. Does that ring a bell? Could you go back to that?
Does that ring a bell for anyone else? What?
I remember the term, but I don't remember what was connected with it. Sorry.
Something to do with
it? Different vehicles, how to create a Buddha. Okay, well, never mind.
Will you say the word again?
Enemy.
Enemy, of golly.
I assume you mean a near enemy. I mean, this interests me because, you know, I sometimes wonder how all this deliberation that goes on in my head is of any use. And sometimes it does feel like a near enemy. It kind of gets in the way, right?
Ah, there it is. Okay, gotcha. So this is Hui Ning's verse commentary. When the mind is in delusion, the flower of Dharma turns. When the mind is in realization, we turn the flower of Dharma. Unless we are clear about ourselves, however long we recite the sutra, it will become an enemy because of its meanings. Yeah. So, yeah, I would say that is, like he's kind of giving a specific antidote to Hotatsu, who has created a self around, like, I know this sutra. And because he didn't have that red mind, that vibrancy, that enough experience of suchness in his rearview mirror, it was coalesced into a self which then became an enemy. It became an obstacle for him. Is that helpful? Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Yes, okay, fine. That's enough. Thank you.
So it's, you know, it's a natural thing as part of our kind of scrabbling for, like, how do I get a handhold? How do I get a foothold on this? We try to admin, we try to make it relate to us. And, you know, it's understandable and it's not very effective.
Okay, thank you.
Question from Carl on the Zoom when you're ready.
We have one in the Zendo.
Okay.
Thank you. I've been a resident since February of this year, and yeah, it's a very visible position. It feels like a very visible position. It feels really external, much more so than I thought it would. And my biggest experience of it, though, has been like such heartfelt, deep gratitude to be able to have this container and to be able to share a residency with the people I'm sharing residency with and with the Sangha at large. And so thank you. I'm grateful for it, too.
Hey, Kakamyo, thank you for your talk. I just want to agree with you that we have a real special situation at Dharma Rain that's just pregnant with possibilities, for people to take advantage of it. It's just like an oasis, you know, out in the desert, or maybe, you know, like planet Earth has such abundant life, and then we look out in the universe and we see that there are many planets that don't have much going on. So it's just an attraction, and I agree with you that it's a special environment both for monastic paths and lay paths. Thank you.
Another in the Zendo.
Well, let's see if I can make sense out of the question that's in my mind here. So you're talking about how we allow for variation. And it sounds like both in terms of how we describe things and how we do formation and how these paths work for people. I've heard some criticism that you can bend it too far and then it becomes something else, or mm-hmm. it may even be like cultural appropriation or misrepresenting the Dharma and the tradition. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that we try to walk some sort of a path in between those two, but I'm wondering if you could address that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, you'll notice that, I didn't draw a lot of hard lines. It's and part of the reason is that it's you know, like, it's not one person's decision. You know, it's an emergent thing that appears in, like, from that interaction effect with the temple and the Sangha. And so, you know, like, we discover what's appropriate. And part of that process of discovery is, you know, taking steps and getting feedback. And so I think, like, the, you know, what I want to lean into is not a sense of, like, defining and concretizing and, like that sort of, like, artificial clarity, but rather a subtlety and a responsiveness and a nuance to, like, what's really needed. And you know, both for the, must be some ducklings walking by,
yes,
behind me.
Yes, yes. We have mama duck and baby ducks.
Yeah, yeah. enjoy. That was my point.
Akamian, we have a question from Daicho on the Zoom.
Okay.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So up until a few weeks ago, I never been to, I don't know, a physical building during rain, and for about a year of like a separation, I mean, physically separated. And so when I was going, then there's a sense of, like, you know, practice happens more there in a building and not so much at home, and which may be a wrong thing to think about, but felt that way. But then, you know, that was taken away for a year. Then I had a sense of, okay, I really need to see and treat my living environment as a sangha.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think to some extent, I think I could do it. Sometimes, you know, Sarah, my wife, would actually point out that, you know, what you're doing, is it a Buddhist thing? And, you know, I would have to say, maybe not. And so, so there's that. But it also seems like there is some, you know, how to do that, how to regard your own living environment as a part of Sangha. Yeah. There seems to be some little, you know, tweaks that you can do to make it better. Do you have some suggestions?
Yeah, sure. Good, and I appreciate the question because it, you know, like, it's underscoring the importance of, like, that. That's why we have terms, right? Like, we move in and out of different phases, different styles of practice. You know, we add intensity and then we release that intensity. And both of those are important. Both of those are like part of the same wave, right? And if we're only, like, willing to acknowledge half of it, like, something's really missing. So, you know, I think part of the practice of like being able to manage those transitions easily, wholesomely, is to, you know, appreciate what's coming. You know, to like look for, oh, what do I derive from this? And, you know, the benefit of like term is there's a particular set of things. The benefit of summer term, of non-ongo schedule, is a whole different set of things. And to, you know, to lean into that, to accept like, oh, these are the conditions that I'm practicing in, and I'm going to absorb this particular kind of nourishment right now. So it's you know, really affirming and accepting what your practice is like.
Thank you.
Pair in the Zendo.
Thank you, Kakamyo. I'd like to kind of explore Tony's question and your response a little bit for myself. So it's really easy for me to have an intention turn into an idea. And it seems that as it slides past home plate into idea land, mm-hmm. It's really easy to get lost and deluded around where, what does that mean about me, mm-hmm. or what mm-hmm. I think is me, or, you know, as opposed to pure intention leading to natural manifestation. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a lot of words, but I, you know, my whole life is in a sea of discernment at the moment, and so that question comes up a lot of like, well, okay, so how much am I playing with the outcome, mm-hmm. and how much am I allowing? Mm-hmm. And if you could maybe, in the terms of like what he was saying, it could become an enemy, and that's obvious. What are the markers to look for? You know, what does that smell like? So you mm-hmm. so you can kind of nip it before it becomes problematic.
Nice. I think you're asking the right question in that, you know, like that activity of selfing is like it's so quick. You know, it's so like you know, almost pervasive. And so like being able to like catch it and withdraw energy from it is most of the practice. I mean, sometimes you get to just like maintain, you know, bright mind. The vast majority of the time, it's plucking attention off something else. Well, I think one of the obvious clues is, and you know, it gets less obvious like the more entrenched one gets with it, but. Like, as we're feeling out, as we're, like, attending to it at the level of intention, at the level of, like, ah, what matters about this, and there's a, it hasn't, like, kind of crystallized into, like, this is what it means to me. It's probably hard to keep your focus on it, right? Like, there's a mistiness to it. It lives lower in the body. There's a kind of quiet, like it's easy to miss, right? And as we add layers of self to a sticking point, it gets more and more obvious. We have more and more like diverging paths that get us back and take us away, and it goes faster and louder and higher. So that general trend, you know, like you can just like check every once in a while, like, well, where am I? Scale of 1 to 10, you know. And, you know, let that guide.
That's useful. Thank you very much.
Kakumi, I'm sorry. If I could add on to that answer, I would say also for me, the smell of that, as soon as I have goals or agendas versus being open to whatever arises, for me, that is my tell that something else is going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. That forward-looking mind.
Yep.
Yep. We have another in the Zendo.
Clear on Zoom so far.
So I was just curious, and maybe I like overlooked you explaining this, but why did your friend feel like he couldn't ordain people?
Yeah, that was probably backstory. I just didn't explain. Well, you know, like he has a smaller sangha. He has a much more online sangha now than he used to. But the sangha has kind of like that's what they want. Like, you know, he's got 30, 50 people, but there's not he doesn't have the ability to do residential practice with them. And there's like there's not enough cohesion and commitment there to, if he was to like ordain someone, the person he ordained would just be living with him and his family, which is an awkward fit. And there's not the temple that the person would be associated with. There's no like home base like that.
So that's what prompted that question that he asked then?
Yeah. He was, okay. You know, he was a transmitted teacher. You know, he kind of, you know, like part of the transmission ceremony is like you're promising to pass this along. And so he felt that weight of responsibility, and that might not be the way to do it.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Last call. There's one more in the Zendo. Hey, Eric.
Good morning, Kikumyo. Thanks for your talk.
Thank you.
This isn't the end of the COVID ongo, but it's certainly the ending of one chapter and the beginning of another. Mm-hmm. This is the first time I've been here in 15 months, and I'm here without a mask. This COVID ongo has really given me an opportunity to reflect upon what is the Sangha and what part does this physical space play in my practice. Mm-hmm. When I shut down, went into quarantine last March, I closed out 8 different things I was doing here. A huge part of my life just came to a stop. And although many aspects of it picked up on Zoom and I became very Zoom proficient, I was often doing 3, 4, 5 Zoom activities a week in here. But what I was struck by was this question of what is my practice without a Sangha? Mm-hmm. And what is my practice without an opportunity to have intimate contact with other members of this community? Mm-hmm. And at first, I was just with the loss. But over time, I came to feel that being on my own and being away from this place and being away from the intimacy of this was clarifying, mm-hmm. that it was important, that it was a chance for me to see what part of this isn't a social construction. Mm-hmm. Because my sense is so much of this is a social construction, that we create this together. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Buddhism or something else, we create it together. That's not necessarily the active ingredient of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I don't know what is, but mm-hmm. I was just struck that the loneliness of my time practicing at home alone, there was something very meaningful about it. And I was also struck coming back today that, you know, I see all these people and I have to say hi and I have to greet people. And that social construction starts back up of what does it mean to be part of this mm-hmm. social venture that we call, you know, our Sangha. I'm not sure where I want to go with my comment because I'm still exploring it. But I'm noticing there's a resistance to me being back here today, which I didn't anticipate. I'm surprised by it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just simply the fact that, you know, one of the ways where my karma touches me deeply is when I have to interact with others socially. Mm-hmm. It's a great challenge for me. But I'm also aware that, you know, the hermit that goes off into the forest to practice by themselves is a fool. That you miss a lot. So I guess I'll continue to wrestle with this, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about the value of solitary practice mm-hmm. away from Sangha mm-hmm. and coming back to Sangha.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, in some ways, it's an echo of some of Daicho's observation. And, you know, what I'm hearing is that, like, you know, you entered that period of COVID ongo with that, you know, looking to, like, what can I get out of this? What's, you know, what can I appreciate here? And maybe not right away, but, you know, you found that. And you found that, like, there were sources of nourishment which you, you know, hadn't really established. And you were able to find something there. And, you know, that's why we change. That's why we like the mode of practice needs to stay fresh, needs to be adaptive, needs to like yes, there's this continuity through time, but there's also this sensitivity to circumstance. And as we're kind of forced to adapt, you know, we just get a better and better picture of, like, what is that, you know, red mind? What really matters? What's the core, you know, pivot point for us?
Okay. I was talking with some visitors today and talking about there are many Buddhisms. Hmm. We talk about Buddhism as though it's something out there and we're going to sort of get a part of it and share it. But I often have this sense that Buddhism is such a uniquely personal affair that I doubt that there's any external Buddhism aside from any part of it that I internalize and create myself. Any reflections on that?
I think there's a lot of external Buddhisms also. I mean, I think there's, it's just, there's so many manifestations. I don't think that external Buddhism, is in any way, taking away from the internal, you know, that esoteric aspect. But the external forms are so myriad. And I like that. It doesn't have to be a particular way.